The Shining Wizards Network proudly present the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast with your hosts, the Impact Playa, Mr. Phil Rea, and Dave Mega Powers, exclusively on the Shining Wizards Network. And now, here they are, Phil and Dave, your new symbol of excellence in sports entertainment broadcasting, the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls and children of a mature age, because let's face it, your boy has potty mouth. From the current to the way back, welcome to another episode of the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. I, of course, as always, your gracious host, the Impact Player, Mr. Phil Rea. I am not joined by the Mega Powers this fine day. Dave decided to oversleep. Dave's alarm didn't go off. I just got off the phone with my partner in crime. He's very upset at himself. He missed the interview. We had to do the interview early in the day because of time constraints. Of course, I have a crazy job. I have one day a week off. And our special guest this week was gracious enough to, come on the podcast and talk about his story. Who I'm talking about is Greg Klein, obviously. Greg is the author of the book that came out last year, The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Professional Wrestling's First Black Superstar. Now, I didn't get a chance to see Mid-South in its heyday for a few reasons. One, because we didn't have cable television. And two, it was very, very regional back then. And I didn't get an appreciation for Mid-South until all these superstars who were superstars there were superstars in the WWF. Guys like, of course, the Junkyard Dog, guys like, Buddy Landell, guys like the Fabulous Freebirds, Butch Reed, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Ted DiBiase, Matt Bourne, who just passed away, you know him better as Doink the Clown, Terry Taylor. These guys were megastars in the Mid-South region, and the trailblazer promoter that was Bill Watts is probably the reason why telling a story in pro wrestling is the way, it's evolved to what you see on Monday Night Raw and SmackDown and what's left of TNA. And we'll get into that in a few minutes because I haven't talked about a lot of current stuff because, again, for a few reasons. One, because I've been bored with the product. Two, because my partnership with Dave has taken off so well that we've just found so much material that we didn't want to talk about anything current because it sucked. But I do have some topics I want to get into since Dave is not with me, and I do have some time to kill. And I'm going to play the interview, which was almost 40 minutes, and it's fantastic. I promise you, it was so fun to talk to Greg. Greg's story is what made me... I've been wanting to talk to Greg for a long time. I just didn't have the technology. But now that I've gotten it, I've read the book almost twice. Because I read the book, and when I booked Greg for the show, I started reading it again. The book is fantastic. Greg's story is one that needed to be told. And he paints this picture of growing up, seeing his dad in the summertime across the country in Texas, and taping this wrestling, and then bringing it back. Which was the pure essence of tape trading. Again, I didn't appreciate Mid-South until I was in high school. But I read, because of tape trading, but I read all the great stories in all the publications we had. Of course, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, The Wrestler, Inside Wrestling, whatever dirt sheet someone had enough money to order. This was before the internet, obviously, and this was before Meltzer even, the original dirt sheet, and Greg goes into his life and how he talks about how, it inspired him to write and act, and he was an indie wrestler, and I think his story is so cool. And of course, come to find out, we're kindred spirits. Greg's a little older than me. His wife is younger than him. Same thing with me. They both have similar backgrounds. And they both, upon meeting us, hear this passion that we have for wrestling. And it just, we connected instantaneously. So I'm kind of glad I got to talk to him. And he's going to be a regular on the show. And I'm glad that his story is told, and he should, you know, I think this book should sing praises if you're a diehard wrestling fan. If you're a wrestling fan that's over the age of 35, you should read this book. If you're a fan of the gimmick era that was the WWF from, you know, the early 80s to the early 90s, and all these guys that were there were superstars in this other promotion, you want to read this book. And it's a great read. It's a fantastic read. And I'm going to play Greg's interview right after I'm done with this, and then we'll come back and with some plugs, and we'll wrap up this awesome episode of the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. A couple of things came across the news wire. I'll do the plugs, like I said, after the interview. 2K Sports, if you're a gamer, has acquired the rights to the WWE game, and the Ultimate Warrior is not only on the game, but he actually advertised for it, and there's been an open Twitter conversation with Vince thanking the Warrior for being a part of the game, and, you know, Warrior, I'm not going to read the excerpts because everybody's been reading them, and, you know, we all know the Warrior story. We all know how WWE, you know, kind of dragged his name into the mud with the self-destruction DVD a couple of years ago, which I thought was a great DVD, only because, you know, anytime you watch a WWE production, and Greg and I got into it with the podcast because the Mid-South DVD is coming out, and Greg was very hesitant to watch it because of, you know, his vision of Mid-South and how WWE is going to now see it. And, you know, they're not going to beat it up, but they're going to talk about certain things, and Greg doesn't know if he's ready for it. And I can understand that. As a wrestling fan, an old-school wrestling fan at that, when you watch these DVDs and you read certain publications, you kind of get a sense of, you know, depending on where that wrestler or that promoter is in their life. And I talked about this again on the interview, that, you know, it depends on where they are in their life. Wrestlers are very finicky. Like, you know, if they're involved, still in the business, they won't talk bad about a lot of people. If they're bitter about certain things, they'll go on these shoot interviews and they'll just shit talk these guys and talk trash. And I think with the Warrior, he was in a different part of his life. And this is me personally, my opinion. I'm not saying it's fact. This is an opinion show, so, you know, if you guys want to debate me, please go right ahead and do it on the Facebook page. And it's funny, because, you know, a lot of these guys destroyed him on that DVD. Bobby Heenan and Triple H, you know, Vince McMahon kind of sort of did, but he didn't. Jim Ross, I mean, all these guys were like, you know, he was a bad guy, you know, even Hogan was like, you know, I didn't have a problem with Jim, but, you know, he held out for money, and Sergeant Slaughter said things, and Pat Patterson. But, you know, I think, and I said this from day one, when I first started watching these shoot interviews, I would tell people, wait 10 years, wait 20 years. Because what guys do now is, they'll do these shoot interviews, you know, say some bad stuff about Vince. 5 years later, they're on television for Vince, because Vince brings these guys back. Vince knows it's money. You know, Vince McMahon, with all his faults, is a very smart dude. And again, he's not promoting wrestling. He's not. He hasn't promoted wrestling in 20 years. He promotes a television show, like Greg Klein said. You know, he is that guy. He is the guy that revolutionized sports entertainment. If you're a wrestling fan, read books like Greg's, watch tapes like I have, watch DVDs, and WWE now is doing a really good job of that. They're putting out the Mid-South stuff. The War Games was fantastic. We talked about that on the anniversary show. The ECW stuff has been good, except for, again, and Shining Wizards, they can, you know, contest this too. The production is great. But the music is what made the promotion, and they added a lot of that shit in it. They added a lot of the music out because it was copyrighted, obviously. And they did it with some of the WCW stuff, too. They just put different music to it. That's my only pet peeve, you know. So, again, the ECW Volume 2 of the Unreleased comes out today. If you're a fan, go get it. The match listing is incredible. Stablemate of the Shining Wizards Network, Justin Credible, is on there, of course. You know, again, there, you know, you have to take these things with a grain of salt. As an old school wrestling fan, I'm happy that the Ultimate Warrior is back in the fold. Is he a little crazy when he does his self-motivational warrior YouTube videos? Of course he is. But you know what? He's 50 years old plus. He's in phenomenal shape. You never heard a bad thing about him with his body. He kept in good spirits. He knew his place in the business. And I think that's what a lot of wrestlers don't do in their old age. They still think they have something left in them to contribute. And you know what? With social media the way it is now, with the internet the way it is now, with all these DVDs and classics on demand, which, of course, you know I love to watch all the time, I think there is a place for everybody in pro wrestling. Or I should say sports entertainment. I think these guys, all their stories need to be told. And let it out. And if you're listening, this goes to everybody. And, you know, I'm glad guys like PJ Polacco, like Justin Credible, I'm glad that when he got his life together, he, you know, his story is a good story. You know, guys like that. I like that. I like a good story. Growing up, not having a lot, not knowing the value of anything until I was an adult, I can appreciate guys that can come back from a demon, that can come back from adversity. It's same thing with an athlete, sports athlete. I like those kind of stories. Pro wrestling is the same thing. If you can come back from the time that, you know, from a time that where you were something in the business, you fell off, and you can come back and you can still contribute, I'm all about that. I don't care that the Ultimate Warrior is on his video game. I mean, my six-year-old does, because he goes upstairs and he opens up his box and he sees all the dolls that myself and Uncle Tommy gave him. And, you know, it's like he sees that. He sees all these characters come to life because I relive it for him. I tell him what I saw, where I was that particular day, that night, where I was sitting. I can tell you that. Who I was with, you know. And I think that is one of the main reasons why I like doing this podcast. Because I love talking about professional wrestling. I'm a sports fanatic. I play fantasy sports. I still play softball and sometimes hockey when time allows me to. But this is my true passion. Professional wrestling and sports entertainment. And I'm glad that I can come on this podcast and have this outlet and share it with all of you guys. And I want to, you know, and I speak for Dave, I speak for the network, I speak for Greg Klein, who thanked me for having this outlet. I say thank you guys for letting me do this and supporting me. Bad critic, good critic, I don't give a shit. I'm not out to, you know, this is not, again, this is a labor of love. We do this with our own money, with our own passion, with my own equipment. I'm sitting in my dining room as we speak. My studio is under renovation, and I'm telling you this, that this was this day particularly is a good day to be a wrestling fan, because you're about to hear a cool kick-ass interview with a very cool righteous dude who respects the business to this day, and he like myself are at a different place in our lives, and we could still go back 25, 30 years and recapture what was the essence of this industry. You know, watching Raw last night, you know, it's nice. Some of the stuff, they're bringing back some storytelling, which is cool. Some of the guys remind me of the throwback wrestlers, you know, cool stuff. Of course, we all know it'll never be the same. Sports entertainment now does not appeal to my demographic of wrestling fan. So you have to have this kind of outlet. I'm glad that my six-year-old gets it. My 10-year-old nephew gets it. And a lot of our friends' kids get it too, so that part for me is cool. They can relive my stuff through this. So, without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to my new friend, Mr. Greg Klein, as he tells about his book, The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Professional Wrestling's First Black Superstar. It is, you can get it at Amazon. That's where I got it, Barnes & Noble. I'm sure there is, you know, you get it on your Kindle or your Nook or your smartphone, whatever. Get this book, okay? Listen to the podcast, listen to Greg Klein's story, and then right after that, immediately go to the store right now and buy the book. It is fantastic. I'm reading it again as we speak, all right? Enjoy the interview. I'll be back with, of course, my long list of shameless plugs, and we'll do a song of the week. Later. All right, so the book is The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Professional Wrestling's First Black Superstar. And I am gracious, as always, your gracious host, the Impact Player, Mr. Philly Rea, joined by the author of this fine publication, Mr. Greg Klein. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good, Phil. How are you?
I am awesome. So, I'll be 40 next year. I had not gotten into any of the Mid-South stuff until high school, only because of tape trading. We didn't get that kind of TV here in New York. Everything was on a UHF channel if it wasn't WWF based. It was like, you know, it was just WWF programming, and you had, you know, Florida and Georgia and sometimes World Class on the UHF stations, and nothing Mid-South until high school. So when I got the book, I was so enthused to read your story and how this book came to pass. So tell me a little bit about your growing up in Maryland, right? You're a Maryland guy, right?
Yeah, I grew up just outside the Beltway, and so I had a lot of the same wrestling that you did. I grew up on WWF, and, you know, the first thing I ever saw was Ray Stevens pile-driving Jimmy Snuka on the concrete. And I don't know what it says about me, but, you know, Jimmy Snuka was quote-unquote paralyzed and bleeding, and I just thought, wow, that's the greatest thing in the world. I got to watch this wrestling thing. So maybe that makes me a little odd. It probably speaks for a lot of us wrestling fans. But, you know, as I got into it, I started seeing other wrestling. I started watching Georgia on the Superstation. But my parents were divorced. My dad lived in Houston. So probably late 1982, I went down to Houston for Christmas, and I saw some Houston City Wrestling, which was Paul Bosch's kind of conglomeration of Mid-South plus highlights from his shows to hype his next show. And I just loved it. I loved it from the very beginning. It was so different to me because, you know, the WWF had like the pattern of, you know, five squash matches and a main event that was never really a main event. It was like SD Jones or Salvatore Bellomo against, you know, whoever was the up and coming heel. And of course you always rooted for the good guy, and of course they always lost. And so it was not the same thing. Mid-South was like a main event, and it was like a real main event. And obviously it was also to hype their shows and to hype their upcoming house shows and things like that. But it was just so much better in terms of the booking and the action. And, you know, obviously Vince McMahon won the war, but at that time in Houston, you know, that's what it was. And so I was just, for the next, you know, 5-6 years of my life, wrestling to me was Mid-South wrestling. And I took in everything. I watched everything. I had the games. I had the video games when they came out. I had the wrestling dolls. I loved, you know, Saturday night's main event. But nothing to me was like Mid-South wrestling. And so that's how I got into it.
Yeah, and it's great because you had that going down to see your dad, and you had that interaction of watching it. Here locally, all we had was the publications to read about this stuff. You know, we had PWI and The Insider and The Wrestler. And so we read about all this great stuff. And again, I didn't see any of this stuff until high school. So it must have been really cool to go somewhere else to see this stuff and then bring it back. It must have been exciting. I mean, as a young fan, it had to be awesome to do that, man. It's fantastic. So
it was great. And, you know, like, now, as I'm in my 40s too, and it's sort of like when you hear a song from the 80s and it brings you back to your youth. That's, you know, what watching the old tapes is like for me too. It's like, oh my gosh, I remember this when I was 14 years old.
And yeah, everybody has that moment in wrestling. Like for you, it was Snuka. For me, it was Piper and Dr. D. David Schultz. I mean, you know, you have that moment And I guess wrestling fans can relate to that. Not other, it's like you said, same thing with music. You know, like, you know where you were when you heard that song. Same thing with wrestling. You know where you were when you saw that, and you know how you felt and how much it dragged you in. So I've been a lifelong fan too. So
yeah, absolutely. I my little brother and I can still talk about how we were at my grandmother's house in Westchester County, what piece of furniture we were sitting on when Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas won the tag team titles from the Samoans, and how the chair went around the Samoan's neck and he was bleeding. And I mean, it's just, you know, it's a great feeling. It's like these memories, and of course non-wrestling fans don't get it, but they get it in other contexts, like you said, with songs and things like that, or a movie. But yeah, you will always remember. And you know, these people that we grew up with are larger than life to us, and it's amazing. You still remember things from the 80s when you can't remember things from, you know, 2013.
Well, that's the thing. I tell people all the time, I'm newly married, and my stepson, who's now 6, he's like a sponge. And he incorporated all my DVDs, well, most of them anyway, the ones he can watch. And we have the encyclopedia now in the magazines, and I tell him stories about, you know, stuff that happened. It's so different now. And we'll get into that, the current stuff in a little while. But I want to get into, you go really in-depth with the promotion itself, which I wasn't really expecting you to do when I got the book. When I saw the book, you know, initially, and I was just hooked on the title itself, I didn't know how in-depth you got into the promotion and how much research you've done. How did you, what inspired you? I know what inspired you to write the book, but what started your research in getting all this to get the book going initially?
Well, it was a couple of things. I think one of it, you know, and I've heard both positive and negative, like it wasn't enough of a biography of JYD, it was more about the promotion. But then I've also heard, wow, he really gives us the history and the backstory. So, you know, I take it all with a grain of salt and just, it is what it is. But I think part of it was this idea of history, you know, this history of there had never been a promotion that had decided to make a black wrestler or an African-American wrestler the center of the promotion. So to go into that backstory, I really had to give some context of what Mid-South Wrestling was and where it came from and who Bill Watts was and where he had this idea and why he followed it up and how he found the Junkyard Dog and, you know, who would have been an acceptable candidate other than the Junkyard Dog and why none of those people worked for him. And so I really had to get into a little bit of the history and the backstory. And, you know, I guess from my perspective, and you can probably tell from reading the book, I really loved it. And, you know, I was writing it in 2010 and we were living in New Orleans, and my wife is a New Orleans girl. She's from what they call the West Bank of New Orleans, and she's a few years younger than me. She grew up just outside of the Mid-South era, and of course, you know, I mean, she's a girl. She's into different things. She's into musical theater and dance and things like that. And when we were living there, I would, like, kind of nudge her and say, hey, honey, that's the Superdome. And she would just look at me like I was crazy and say, you know, I grew up here. I spent 22 years of my life here. I know what the Superdome is. And I say, no, you don't understand. That's where Mid-South Wrestling had all these famous matches, and that's where in 1980 the Junkyard Dog got his revenge on Michael Hayes and the Freebirds after they blinded him, and, you know, it drew a record crowd for wrestling, and it's where some of the most famous matches of wrestling took place, and I can't believe it. I can't believe we're driving past it. It's just so great. And, you know, I tell this story a lot. I mean, we were both Simpsons fans. We're both Simpsons fans, and she kind of looked at me and she said a Lisa Simpson line, which was, I know all those words, but that sentence made no sense to me.
We're like kindred spirits. Not only am I 6 years older than my wife, but she's also a local theater person here too. So explain to a non-wrestling fan these events and stuff that goes on. It's mind-boggling to them. So I totally get where you're coming from. So
it's hard. It's impossible. And like I said, I was explaining this to a girl who had spent the first 22 years of her life growing up in New Orleans. I mean, she was born in 79, so she's slightly younger. I mean, you know, even if she had been into wrestling, which of course she wasn't, she wouldn't have really caught Mid-South. She might have caught UWF, but, you know, her family was just not into that sort of thing. And you know, not just her. I mean, her mom and her grandmom and her uncle and you know, some of them have read my book. I mean, I'm really grateful to them for taking the time to read it, even though it's about wrestling and they don't get it. But, you know, they've said to me, wow, I didn't know this history about my city. And so, you know, that's kind of what started me going, was here was this lost history. I mean, the Junkyard Dog, as one of the stories says, in 1982 was voted, you know, by the kids of New Orleans as the athlete that they'd most want to come talk to them, and that was the era of Archie Manning and Pistol Pete Maravich, and
right.
It shocked people. You know, how could this professional wrestler from this, you know, how people describe it, this fake sport, you know, be more popular? But of course, it was New Orleans. It was, you know, 70% African American, and you know, that's who the kids wanted to see, and it just blew everybody's mind. So how can you go from that to 25 years later, 30 years later, where Sylvester Ritter, you know, who played the Junkyard Dog, who became the Junkyard Dog, is, you know, deceased, and Mid-South is gone, and you know, WWE rules the world, and nobody remembers him, not even in New Orleans, where he was this huge star. And, you know, one of the stories that I told in the book was when the Saints won the Super Bowl, there was this huge article about the Who Dat chant. You know, Who Dat think they're going to beat them Saints? And it started, I mean, well, it's got many diverse stories of how it started, but one of the ways that it spread to the Saints was the fact that it became a chant for the Junkyard Dog. And it, you know, in 1982 and 1983, the chant was, "Who dat think they're going to beat that dog?" And that was his, you know, cheer. That was his battle cry. I mean,
right.
The way, you know, the way wrestling is now, that would be like his catchphrase or his gimmick. And, you know, it was the same building. Like, literally the next fall, it started being used for the Saints. And so the writer of the Times-Picayune in New Orleans wrote this huge story. It was a front-page story. It jumped to an inside page. The inside page was a complete full page about the origins of the Who Dat chant, and it didn't mention the Junkyard Dog at all. And, you know, when I contacted the writer, he was a little touchy. He didn't want to be quoted for the book. You know, the only thing he really said was that, you know, hundreds of people have contacted him to tell him that, no, they were the ones that started the Who Dat chant. No, it was this football team in this year in this place in New
Orleans,
Louisiana. And so, you know, I mean, I think I misspoke when I said it started with the Junkyard Dog. It didn't start with the Junkyard Dog. It was kind of a regional thing, but, you know, it certainly, you could certainly draw the conclusion that it spread from the dog to the Saints, and that was a key link. And he just left it out completely, and he didn't seem to have any idea who the Junkyard Dog was. And so, again, that was kind of, you know, how could this be that everybody has forgotten Sylvester Ritter, especially when you take the historical aspect of who this guy was and how nobody had thought that you could make an African-American wrestler the star of the show. I mean, that was, you know, Bobo Brazil was the semi-main event guy who always won. You know, he was like the Pedro Morales. You couldn't have him lose because that would start a riot amongst his fans, and then his fans would never come back again if
That's
he wasn't
right.
unbeatable.
Right.
So to do it with the Junkyard Dog and make him the headliner was a really big deal. And I thought it was, you know, a shame that it was lost history. And I thought it was amazing that it was, you know, in Louisiana, in the Deep South, as opposed to, say, New York City or someplace like that.
So who were some of the people that, I mean, besides this writer, obviously, who were some of the people that you actually started reaching out to get more information about about that particular time in wrestling in the Mid-South and the promotion that was?
You know, I tried to talk to everybody, and one of the most frustrating things about it was that none of the wrestlers would seem to talk to me. And you know, a couple of years later, I can look back and go, okay, well, Tony Atlas was writing his book at the time, and, you know, Bill Watts and Ted DiBiase had already written their books, and Buddy Landell was off, you know, being a minister or whatever he's doing now. And so I don't know exactly why people didn't respond to my interview requests, you know. However, what I did instead was go to the streets of New Orleans and talk to fans and go to, you know, Sylvester Ritter's hometown of Wadesboro, North Carolina, and talk to his coaches. I went to his college, Fayetteville State University, and talked to his football coach. So, you know, that was one of the best things to me, and I think it's one of the things that was, you know, most warmly received, was that I got this history of his life growing up and really found out who Sylvester Ritter was before there was a Junkyard Dog. And I really enjoyed that part of it. I think if I write another book, I definitely will, you know, do that for whoever I write the book about.
Well, I want to talk about Bill Watts for a second. And
yeah.
And, well, the thing is, a lot of wrestling fans, the quote-unquote, the new internet wrestling community, and you know how that goes, these younger fans, I don't think they appreciate the trailblazer that was Bill Watts. Mm-hmm. The pioneer promoter that, you know, he revolutionized the storyline. And he's probably the reason why Junkyard Dog was so popular, again, because of his booking style. Tell me a little bit about what you got out of Bill Watts in terms of when you were writing the book. What were your thoughts on him, and what do you think his place in the business is? I know he's a Hall of Famer, and rightfully so. WWE recognized him anyway, and he was an already established wrestler before he became a promoter. So, like, tell me about how you feel about him as a personality in the business.
Sure. Well, you know, you kind of have to look at him from several different perspectives, I think. You know, he was a Hall of Fame wrestler. I mean, he was a main event wrestler everywhere he went. You know, he was ahead of his time in terms of his size. I mean, he was a headliner against Bruno Sammartino in the WWWF.
Yes, he was.
He was, you know, he was a legend in Oklahoma. You know, like everybody, seemingly, except for maybe Ernie Ladd, his football history is exaggerated. He wasn't actually a college football player. He got kicked out of Oklahoma, or he left Oklahoma after some disciplinary problems. But he was, you know, 300 pounds, and he was lifting weights, and he was huge. So he matched up with guys like Bruno where other people didn't. And he was a great talker. He was a pretty good worker. You know, he was no Dory Funk or Jack Briscoe, but he was a pretty good worker for the era. He knew how to tell a story. And because he was so successful, he eventually was cut into the Oklahoma territory, what was Tri-States Wrestling back in the day. And he was, you know, a guy that really took to promoting. He went to Florida, and he learned from Eddie Graham. He got involved in the wars in Georgia, and he became a really good booker. And I think that he did, like, if you watch Raw today, I think that what he did, you see on Raw, where, you know, not the philosophy on, you know, WWE that results don't count necessarily, because for Bill Watts, everything was important and everything counted and everything had to be realistic. So that, what they do is opposite of that. But in terms of being able to put on a main event, you know, in terms of being able to give something away on TV and still feel like it was promoting your next commercial endeavor, whether it was a house show or today, you know, a pay-per-view, he did that, and his ratings were incredible. I mean, you know, the ratings for Mid-South probably will never be matched by a Raw or something like that, in terms of local markets, obviously. And, you know, he was revolutionary in his day. Now, you know, growing up and loving Mid-South, like everybody else, I was excited when he took over WCW in 1992, and then disappointed, you know, less than a year later when it all sort of fizzled out, and you know, he didn't have the same success. But, you know, the business passed him by, and I think it does that to a lot of old-timers. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't really an indictment of him so much as it was just something that seems to happen in this business, where the business changes and people remember what it was when they were headlining or they were promoting, and, you know, it becomes something else that they can't adapt to. He's an interesting guy. I mean, he definitely, by his own admission, had a temper problem, had an anger problem. You know, Jake Roberts famously said that, you know, when Bill Watts dies, there'll be a line of people waiting to piss on his grave. So, you know, he wasn't necessarily a nice guy, especially when he was, you know, an active wrestler and when he was a promoter. It seems like a lot of guys hate him or hated him. I don't know if they still hate him, you know, or they've adapted to him. You know, I feel like if I had been wrestling for him, maybe I wouldn't like him as much as I did, but I loved his product, and that's sort of what caused me to like him. You know, reading some of his philosophies, I mean, he's definitely what you would call a libertarian. You might compare him to like a Ron Paul or Rand Paul. I don't think that he was making a great political statement. I think he was making a business decision, putting Junkyard Dog on top. But you still have to admire the fact that he made that decision and he ran with it. And, you know, Louisiana at that time, and probably at this time, is one of the more corrupt states in terms of state government and local government,
yeah,
and, you know, local politics. I mean, you know, when I say that to Southerners or people from Louisiana, they point out that, you know, you and I live in New York, and New York has its own rich history of corrupt politics.
Well, absolutely.
And that's true. You know, we're not debating that. I'm just saying, like, if you made a list, Louisiana is somewhere in the top five and probably still is, you know. And the thing is, these were like good old boys, you know. And when Edwin Edwards was the governor of Louisiana, he just basically, you know, I don't know if he perfected the kickback or he invented the kickback or how you would say it, but, you know, he basically had a whole state full of cronies that were on the payroll in one way or another. And every one of them that was on the payroll then, you know, had to give some of the money back in a slush fund. So the promoters in the state of Louisiana didn't really promote. They held the promoter's license. And, like, in Louisiana, there was one promoter, and that was, you know, Tri-State Wrestling, and then it was Mid-South Wrestling. And so, you know, it was a monopoly. You could not get in. And you had to use Edwin Edwards, you know, quote-unquote promoters to promote your matches in every city. And so a lot of these guys were, you know, hardcore, old-school, plantation-owning, you know, racists. I mean, there's no other way to say it, basically. And they did not like the idea that a black man was now beating all the white men, and the black man was, you know, the star of the show. And, you know, because Bill Watts was Bill Watts, you were not going to threaten him. You were not going to, you know, kick his ass or anything like that. I mean, you know, if anything, he was going to kick yours. So he really had to stand up for his business and stand up for his decision and say to these people, look, you know, you're going to do this, and I don't care what you think. You're not working for me. You're getting a cut of the gate to just sit back and, you know, be the figurehead promoter. And, you know, he said in his biography that he figured that it cost him probably $200,000 a year in kickbacks to do business in the state of Louisiana. So, I mean, that's, you know, even in the great times, he was losing money because of this system that Edwards had set up. So it was a very interesting system. It was a very interesting time and place in, you know, wrestling history. And it was, I think it was kind of ballsy, you know, to go ahead and do it. And to do it in Louisiana, which, you know, as I said in the book, there was very little history of wrestling being successful in New Orleans. Now, since then, people have told me that, you know, it was successful in Louisiana and other places in Louisiana and, you know, across the river or up north in Louisiana. But New Orleans had basically a five-year history of success for wrestling, and that was when Junkyard Dog was the star of the show.
Right, and, you know, I think Bill Watts, also to his credit, he, and you mentioned it right when I asked you, he was the guy that revolutionized putting guys in a position where they really shouldn't have been. And I'm not saying race, I'm talking about, like, in terms of ability. Like, Junkyard Dog wasn't a great wrestler. Jim Duggan wasn't a great wrestler, but he put them in main event spots and got them over. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the draws were amazing. Like, you mentioned a lot of the cards in the book, but even, you know, back then there was still territory swapping. So you would have an occasional visit by Ric Flair or Harley Race or, you know, guys from up north. I mean, but you had, you know, they had that you know, no matter how much money he lost, he always drew a big crowd. And the Freebirds and the Midnight Express and all these guys that before they were NWA staples and Georgia staples, they were in New Orleans. They were in the Mid-South Territory. So, you know, it's and he was the guy who split the locker rooms up, and he was the guy that was very adamant on breaking kayfabe and all the other stuff. He was that guy. So, yeah, you know, I'm glad he got his due, you know, and I'm glad that It took the route it did, because it actually made guys like Ron Simmons a superstar too, and he was booking for WCW, and, you know, that thing. So, you know, it was good for its time, and you very much articulated a lot of the events so well in this book that I felt like I was actually, you know, sitting watching it either there or on television. Like, I just remember reading about some of those dome shows, and I'm like, as a teenager going, wow, this had to be amazing to be there to see, you know?
Yeah, I think so. You know, my buddy Joe and I, he was kind of my running mate of going to matches when we were in our teens, and we both wanted to break into the business. We both kind of broke into the business, at least on a very, you know, small level, indie shows and things like that. And I was in it a little longer than him as an indie guy. But, you know, when we were teenagers and we were just discovering the sheets and we were figuring out what the business really was on the inside, and we had a sort of a quote that we would say back and forth to one another about booking people and how you ran a promotion. And it was limit the limited. That's what we used to say to one another. And, you know, you could see it. I mean, Paulie Dangerously, Paul Heyman is a master of that. You know, he took a guy like 9-1-1, who was, you know, who had no skills at all, basically, and he gave him the one move, the choke slam, and for a couple of years, he was this huge success in ECW. You know, he took Public Enemy, and they were not great workers, and anytime you took them out of ECW and you tried to put them in another spotlight, you know, they were kind of exposed for not being very good workers, but he gave them this personality and put them on the mic, and, you know, they became this cult act for a couple of years, and Tommy Dreamer and, you know, Raven, and, you know, it was amazing how many guys were big stars in ECW that, you know, never were stars again. And us ECW fans were like, well, why, you know, why do they go to WCW or WWE and become jobbers, or become, you know, not jobbers necessarily, but mid-level guys? And it was because Paulie Dangerously was a visionary as a booker, and he could take a guy and he could find his strength, and he could do nothing but promote that strength. And I think Bill Watts was that guy too. I mean, you know, Hacksaw Duggan, I have to say that if you saw Jim Duggan in 1982, he had so much energy, and he had, I mean, he was a star. You know, you can crack on him the way he was in the 1990s because it's fair game. You know, he was awful. And Junkyard Dog was the same way. I mean, if you saw him in 1982 and you looked at his physique, he looked like Tony Atlas. It was amazing what good shape he was. And, you know, I didn't say this in the book because it was like after the fact that I sort of realized it. If it gets a reprinting, I'll get some pictures and put them in and talk about it a little more. But when you look at Junkyard Dog in the WWF in 1988, and you take a picture and you compare him to Junkyard Dog in 1982 wrestling Ted DiBiase and Matt Bourne, it doesn't look like the same guy. It's amazing. But, you know, that accepted, he was not a great worker. I mean, you're absolutely right. He was, you know, he was put in with great workers. He was put in with Ted DiBiase, and he was put in with Butch Reed, and he was put in with Mr. Olympia, who was such an underrated guy in terms of being a good worker in the business. And he was put in with these guys who could, you know, leave him in the center of the ring and hit every rope and run circles around him and exploit the storylines and exploit the fans' emotions. And, you know, on TV, he had two-minute matches. He got in and got out. It's like what they did with Goldberg, you know, in WCW a decade later.
Yep.
And, you know, you put him on the mic, and he was a great interview. He was a phenomenal interview. You know, this was, again, not when you're seeing him in the WWF barking and howling and, you know, doing the shtick. This was when he was talking about how Butch Reed was sleeping in his house, and Butch Reed got the, you know, was brought into Mid-South by the Junkyard Dog, and Butch Reed was his protege, and Butch Reed betrayed him, and it was, you know, like black-on-black crime. I mean, when he said that, I guarantee you every fan in the world that was in New Orleans or in Houston or in Oklahoma wanted to kill Butch Reed, you know, and that's what it was. It was just, you know, it was the way that the promotion found these gems and exploited, or maybe exploited is the wrong word, but utilized their talent and only their talent, and hid their, you know, hid their faults. And, you know, when you went to another promotion, they didn't necessarily appreciate that. And that's, you know, that's kind of the history of the territories, and that's the history of wrestling. And, you know, the WWF didn't care if they had bad matches when they became national, because they were promoting something different, you know.
That's right, yes.
And like Vince McMahon says, you know, I mean, he's not promoting wrestling, he's promoting a TV show, he's promoting, you know, the show, he's promoting the circus. You know, Bill Watts was promoting wrestling, and he was promoting storyline, and he was promoting soap opera, and he wanted you to tune in again next week to see what happened. And, you know, it's very different than it is today, obviously, but like you said, he was a master at getting stuff out of people that maybe another promoter missed or didn't get, you know. And Junkyard Dog and Jim Duggan were certainly two of those guys that, you know, were living proof of that.
I mean, the list goes on and on, Greg. You had guys like Dr. Death, C. Williams, Matt Bourne. You had, of course, Jim Duggan, Ted DiBiase, the whole Rat Pack thing. By the time those guys made it up north, I was already a teenager singing their praises only because of the wrestling magazines and the stuff that you read prior. Like, I wish I would have saw him, you know, with the black glove on, and I wish I would have saw guys like Butch Reed and you know. So this, but the book is so that, again, and I know you got some negative press about how you didn't talk more about the JYD, but I don't think you had to. I think the story of Mid-South in a whole coincides with JYD and how he became this larger than life character. And yeah. and for a lot of wrestling fans that have not lived through it or have not seen it, you know, I think it's through the eyes of an older fan, and nothing against a younger fan, because they're the basis of why we do all these podcasts now and stuff like that. You know, I think it's the book is a credit to a younger fan now. They're definitely going to appreciate the era that was the territories, and this particular territory, which was the Mid-South. So, are you happy that the library finally got to WWF, WWE, I should say, and actually in a couple of weeks they're going to be releasing the first DVD?
I don't know. I have mixed feelings, I guess. You know, I grew up with that sort of strange feeling in my stomach when my favorites would get to the WWF. You know, I was such a, like you, you know, I was such a student of the magazines. I mean, I had that Pro Wrestling Illustrated wrestling game that they used to sell before the lawsuits and things like that. And I used to make my own. You know, my buddy Joe and I used to get together and we would take a videotape and we would see everybody's moves and we would figure out what their specialty move was and we would assign the point values. And so, you know, we had, I don't know, two or three versions of the game, you know, that we would buy for whatever it was, $10, $12, $15. And they would each come with like 35 wrestlers. But I swear I probably had 300 wrestlers, because every wrestler that I read about in the magazine, or every wrestler that I saw on TV, every wrestler that I saw in the ratings and in the after magazines, I would make my own card for those wrestlers. And
of course.
And I would say for probably 5 years of my life, you know, everybody, every adult who knew me was like, what are you doing, Greg? And I'd be like, oh, I'm playing my wrestling game. You know, my dad was a doctor, and when I would visit him in Houston, he would take me in, you know, a couple days during the summer. And he had these x-ray boards, you know, with light boards, and I would pin all my wrestling cards up to the light boards. And my, you know, I feel like I'm saying something that only people of our era are going to know what the heck I'm talking about. But, you know, I would put them up on the light board, and I would have my pin chart, and I would have my steel cage chart, and I would have my Texas death chart, you know, and I would make my own cards, and I had my own rankings, and I had, you know, this is the Florida territory. Okay, today I'm going to do the Florida territory, and I've got a title match between the champion, and, you know, I would have a grand tournament once a year where I had every wrestler in the tournament. And so, you know, I felt like I knew who all these guys were, even the ones that I had never seen wrestle, but especially the Mid-South guys. You know, when they came to the WWF, I wanted them to be the same guy they were in Mid-South, and it was always a source of frustration to me, you know, this is not a Mid-South guy, but when, you know, why was Dory Funk Jr. Hoss Funk? Or why was Harley Race not acknowledged as the NWA champion?
Exactly.
Or why, you know, why was Butch Reed the Natural rather than Hacksaw Butch Reed? And, you know, and why did they do what they did to Terry Taylor? You know, I could spend the rest of my life wondering why they did what they did. why did Terry Taylor, I know, again, it's like this minutiae, but why did Terry Taylor and Kurt Hennig come in the same month, and one of them became Mr. Perfect and the other one became, you know, the Red Rooster?
Yeah.
And how did they decide? You know, I loved Terry Taylor. I don't know why, but because he was a Mid-South guy and he got a big push there, I guess. You know, and Dr. Death. Dr. Death was my favorite. You know, he was my absolute favorite of all time. And, you know, he was never, other than Japan, where, of course, he was a legend, but, you know, I couldn't see that on TV. You know, he was never the same guy in WCW or WWF. So, you know, I have mixed feelings about the way that they represent their history. I think anybody that has read, like, the Observer histories of wrestling, you know, understands sort of the truth about what the wrestling war was and what the territories were, and we all have our favorites and we all want to see it represented in a certain way. So it's hard. I talked to Michael Watts, one of Bill's sons. He, you know, ultimately did not want to be part of the book, but, you know, he was still trying to make a go of selling the tapes, which his mom got in a divorce settlement, you know, and running a business based on selling the tapes and selling the memorabilia. And he tried for, you know, half a decade at least to make it the family business, to continue to sell those memories. And so, you know, I don't begrudge him ultimately for selling out, you know, any more than I begrudge Mike Graham for selling out, or you know, Kevin Von Erich.
Yeah.
Yeah, or Greg Gagne. Yeah. You know, I mean, I, you know, there is no pension for these guys. There is no, you know, royalties for the most part for these guys. I, you know, you have to, anybody that's still making a buck off their name, you know, I mean, the Armstrong family in Alabama are legends and nobody realizes that. But, you know, when they go to a house show in Alabama, they make a lot of money just selling, you know, memorabilia, Armstrong family reunion memorabilia. And Bob Armstrong, you know, I don't know if he still is, but when I was on the indie scene in Alabama, he was probably, you know, 65 years old, but, you know, his boys still took him to the matches and he still wrestled a match and he didn't make, you know, take a lot of bumps, but he was still this, you know, the bullet. He was the legend and they made enough money that they could, you know, keep him working and keep him, you know, in a good lifestyle. And I salute that. I like that. You know, it's like an old baseball player that, you know, didn't make the millions of dollars but still gets to go give autographs or whatever. So I don't begrudge the Watts family for ultimately selling it to the WWE. Like everybody else who loved the Federation that was not, you know, WWF, there's a part of me that thinks, okay, are they really going to tell the story accurately? Are they going to represent, you know, the wrestlers that I loved fairly? You know, but I guess when push comes to shove, they're putting out the DVD to make a dollar. And so, you know, they're not going to be Dusty Rhodes and kill off the UWF for the sake of ego. They're going to, you know, they're going to put the best shine on it that they can, and they're going to sell it the best way that they can. You know, that said, am I going to buy it? I don't know. I'll wait and see, you know, how the bills are that month and what kind of disposable income we have that month. And you know, do I have the time to sit down and watch it, or am I just better off watching my tape trade tapes again, or my, you know, the ones that I bought from the Watts family when they were selling them again, or, you know what I mean? It's, I have mixed feelings. I don't know how to deal with it really. It's not, you know, here's what it is, and again, this goes back to what we were saying before. It's not Mid-South history. It's my history, you know? And that's right. A weird thing to say. I was a teenager, and I loved it, and it's about going to see my dad and being so excited for that first Saturday night when Houston City Wrestling came on, or that Sunday morning when Houston City Wrestling came on, sitting there with my VHS tape and waiting to tape it, and being so excited and having my stepmom and my stepsisters all look at me and make their snide comments, and, you know, going over to my neighbor's house and hearing what was going on in the 6 months since I had last been there, and, you know, going to the Sam Houston Coliseum. So I don't know if you know, Vince McMahon and Triple H and Jim Ross, you know, can accurately portray that. I mean, Jim Ross should be able to, but, you know, I don't know. And so I don't know how to deal with it. And it's weird. I feel myself choking up a little bit talking about it, because it's like, it's not their history. It's my history. It's you know, all of us middle-aged guys who loved it when we were kids and the things we remember about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And I can't get this out of my system. And like you, you know, your story is one of the best stories ever. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I've read so many biographies and I've read so many books about professional wrestling since I'm in junior high school. And wrestlers, depending on where they are in their lives or where they are politically in the business, will tell you a different side of the story of what happened. So I understand where you're coming from in terms of, I don't know if I'm going to buy it or see it. Like, I wish I had those tapes. I wish I had that connection that you had, you know? You know, I'm going to buy the DVD, but take a lot of it with a grain of salt just to see the footage and the production, because I'm a geek like that. But,
yeah.
You know, but your story is so awesome that, you know, we're kindred spirits, Greg, and I mean that wholeheartedly, because, you know.
No, I appreciate
you know,
that.
And it's great because, you know, And now that I'm doing this podcast, and all we talk about is old wrestling, old school wrestling.
Right.
You know, and we take matches from, like, you know, this from the 60s to even the early 2000s. We pick apart a storyline, or we pick apart a particular match or a card, and we talk about it the way, almost like the way you talk about it, where we were, what we were doing, what was going on at the time. And you know, I understand that if you don't want to see it, you know, I understand if you it may tarnish the memory that you have of going to see your old man. And listen, I did the whole thing too with the E-Feds and the wrestling cards and the Champions of the Galaxy, and I even incorporated that. I didn't have the X-ray machine like you did, but I did all that. My six-year-old stepson did it last night. So, you know, I kid you not, you know, he grabbed a pen and a paper, and we were watching the War Games DVD, and I told him how awesome it was to see that as a kid, and he totally booked like three different matches. So, I mean, for me, it's a great feel. So, before we wrap this up, what are you doing now? What's Greg Klein doing now? And professionally, what's going on with you? And you want to plug anything? Is something going on? Are you doing any more books or?
Well, first of all, I would just tell everybody to, you know, my Twitter handle is @JYDBook. So you're welcome to follow me @JYDBook. I'm working on a follow-up about my time as an indie wrestler. It's called Weekend Warrior, and it's about a 4-year period in my life where, you know, I didn't make it to WrestleMania, but I sort of fulfilled my goal of getting into the business and figuring out what wrestling really was. And I wrestled for a couple of years as Billy the Kid and J.J. Havoc, and for a year I was a bootleg Doink the Clown, and I had a couple good matches. I wrestled Greg the Hammer Valentine, I wrestled Bugsy McGraw, I got to know the Armstrongs a little bit, you know, I got to know some of these people that I had grown up watching. I'm also thinking about doing a follow-up biography, maybe Wahoo McDaniel, maybe Ernie Ladd, someone, you know, one of these old-timers that we loved back in the day. You know, I worked as a reporter at a newspaper up in Cooperstown called the Cooperstown Crier. You're welcome to like us on Facebook. I cover a lot of baseball stuff, of course, being up in Cooperstown.
Yeah.
You know, I've been an actor. I worked on 24. I have a Wiki 24 page that I kind of use as my launching pad, as my website, where I link to all my other stuff. I'm a screenwriter. I'm trying desperately some days and more calmly other days to get a movie made. You know, I've run a couple of Indiegogo campaigns to raise money. I'm hoping to shoot a trailer for the film called Rebels Without Causes next fall or winter in New Orleans. And you know, that's it. It's a different kind of hustle. You know, it's as Terry Taylor and Buddy Landell used to say, "Fake it till you make it." You know, here I am at a different stage in life, but still trying to do the things I love. Still trying to be creative. Trying to get a movie made or sell a screenplay, and kind of go from there.
Absolutely. Well, the book is, of course, The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Professional Wrestling's First Black Superstar. And Greg, your story needs to be told. I'm glad it was told. And I'm glad that you came on the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. You are welcome anytime. Even if something's not going on, you want to just shoot the breeze, talk some wrestling with Dave and myself, we would definitely love to have you on. If you ever come up this way, you know, we're always doing stuff like we're doing like the Legends of the Ring stuff in October, and we have a network of podcasts that we roll with now. We're on a ground level of something big, I think, in terms of podcasting and internet radio. So our stories want to be told, and we want to share stories like yours all the time. So we, on behalf of Dave and the network and, of course, myself, I want to thank you for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honor to speak with you, man. This is an awesome time.
Yeah, absolutely, Phil. Well, thanks for speaking with me. And, you know, people always thank me for what I do, and, you know, I have one book. So I thank you guys for doing what you do every week. And you know, it's guys like us that'll keep these people alive, in a sense. And so I just think that's a great thing. And, you know, thanks for having me.
No, no problem. Anytime, man. Seriously, anytime you want to plug something or you want to come on, just let me know. And Dave and I will definitely get you on, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Take care, man.
All right, you too.
All right.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
This is the Black Scorpion. And when I'm not looking for Sting, I'm listening to the Shining Wizards podcast. ShiningWizards.com. Be a mark. Buy the shirt. been coming for you, Sting.
Neckbreaker Podcast! Neckbreaker Podcast is a pro wrestling and heavy metal themed podcast. Guest interviews, wrestling headlines, and metal news while your hosts Brian and John get completely fucking shit-faced. Past guests include Eric Bischoff, Fit for an Autopsy, Power Glove, and many, many more. Join them exclusively on the Shining Wizards Wrestling Network. Neckbreaker Podcast!
Big Phil here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Please check out my boys Mike and Adam, hosts of the Midnight Jury Podcast, the only podcast that transports you back to the last old school generation as they debate in detail 80s and 90s pro wrestling, horror movies, and pop culture. Before the internet, before Blu-ray, before cell phones, there was the last old school generation. So check out my boys on the Midnight Jury exclusively on the Shining Wizards Network. Hey, Big Phil here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Check out two professional wrestlers, Pat Buck and Kevin Matthews, and some other guy, Jay Silva, giving insight to the wonderful yet corrupt industry of pro wrestling. Check out Two and a Half Wrestlers, the bad boys of podcasting, exclusively on the Shining Wizards Network. Hey guys, Phil Raya here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Check out Pro Wrestling 101. It's a show about the ins and outs of pro wrestling, hosted by 20-year veteran of the Squared Circle, Just Incredible. Now that's not just the best, that's not just the coolest, that's Just Incredible on the Shining Wizards Network. Hey, Phil Ray here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Listen to Wrestling Soup every Thursday night, 10:15 p.m., live on WrestlingSoup.com. Anthony Missionary Thomas, Joey Numbers, best fans in the world. It's a complete shitstorm. Trust me, I know. It's got everything. It's got bitches. It's got bagels. It's got retarded women. It's got everything. Check it out. WrestlingSoup.com. Wrestling-news.com. That's right, wrestling-news.com. Those are my pals, Don Tony and Kevin Castle, one of the best shows on the planet, spot-on predictions, awesome, awesome commentary, and they're a bunch of cool dudes. Check them out exclusively on wrestling-news.com, live every Monday, right after Raw, 11:15. Tell them Phil sent you, and you'll get completely nothing. Big Phil here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Check out my two buds, Will Sweeney, Chris Espo, Tattoos and Touchdowns, All Football, All the Time, every Tuesday live, exclusively on RadioInfluence.com. Tattoos and Touchdowns, baby. All right, so that was Mr. Greg Klein, the author of The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Professional Wrestling's First Black Superstar. I want to thank Greg for coming on. It's been long overdue, and his story is fantastic. If you are an old-school wrestling fan like myself, you need to get on this. Go to Amazon.com, get the book, Barnes & Noble, your Nook, your Kindle, your smartphone, however you're reading books these days, go get it. It's a good read. And we're going to have Greg back on the show real soon. And should be a fun time. Mega Powers, shame on you, sir. You missed it. Sorry you missed it. But Dave and I are working on a huge guest for the next, the next couple podcasts, hopefully. We'll just let you know that he's a Hall of Famer, a former WWF superstar. And we'll leave it as that. I will be contacting him later in the week, finding out what a good schedule is for him to call in. And hopefully Dave will not be asleep and not, you know, doing his thing, and he could be at the dome doing our thing, man. So I do. I have all the shameless plugs recorded. You've already heard them already. I'm not going to get into them. A couple things I just want to touch on that we didn't get to do last week, because after our last show, we had a tragedy in the Rantham Radio camp on RanthamRadio.com. I want to thank Double A and those guys again for putting this on. But after their anniversary show, the Rant, which is every Tuesday at 8 p.m. live, cheap plug, they had a death in their family. Problem child, one of the personalities, mid-20s, passed away, fiance and a baby left behind. So sad. I tried to call in to give my condolences, but the phone lines were flooded, as expected. But I wanted to take this time, Dave, on behalf of Dave and myself and the network, I want to pay my condolences to Problem Child and his family, and of course Double A and their camp for their loss. He was a good personality. He was fun to listen to. Those guys are great. They have great chemistry. And that's how I was going to tell them when I called in, that I love listening to their show. It's a great, you know, they feed off each other very well. And, you know, I want to thank them again for putting us on. And, of course, we extend the olive branch. Anytime they need something, always, you know, reach out to us and we'll be there. But Rantham Radio does move on in good spirit. And we have the saying in emergency medical services when someone passes away, rest easy, we'll take it from here. So Problem Child, we love you, rest easy. We got this, brother. We'll take this. And RanthamRadio.com will be better than ever in your name. And I hope when your daughter is old enough, she gets to hear all the cool stuff that you guys have done in the past. She will appreciate the awesomeness that was you in the Rant. Check out the Rant. What are you reading? The Wrestling Call-In Show. There's a whole bunch of cool stuff going on RanthamRadio.com. It's in rotation. You can download the TuneIn app and listen to all that stuff as well, as well as my show, Turnbuckle Throwback Wrestling Podcast. Now on RanthamRadio.com and exclusively on the Shining Wizards Network. You already know about the network. I just plugged all their shows. Be about it. Handsome Dan Lopez's blog is on Wrestling Ramble, and as well as, I believe, Ben and the Ring Wars guys. He's a part of that. And I had a little debate with Mr. Lopez on his last article about stables and heel factions, and I put my two cents in. So, of course, we love Dan. Dan's a big supporter of the show. Mel and Corey spoke to them on Twitter last night. Women who love wrestling, I miss you guys. You got to do more shows. If I can help you in any way, please message me. Again, I want to help. So, and you guys should be on more often. I'm going to leave it as that. All right. I spoke to Paul Dube last night. Sports Den, support those guys. Mish and Joey are back on the soup. Hello to you guys. Miss you guys. Shout out to everybody that's been listening. It's been a fun ride. We're having a blast. We got big things in the works. The Decadome is being renovated. I'm going to be sounding a bit more professional. And, of course, check out the Man Cave with me and JP. This Sunday, my big birthday show, on my birthday, August 4th, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m., exclusively on morelikeradio.com. We're live. And we're going to have some birthday fun. Hopefully we'll have a special guest if he answers my fucking emails. Hint, hint. And I think that's going to be it for now. I'm stealing a playbook. I'm stealing from the Shining Wizards playbook, I should say. The Song of the Week. Song of the Week is Atomic Dog by George Clinton. Of course, since we talked about the Junkyard Dog, that was JYD's song before he was in the WWF. Before Queens, Another One Bites the Dust, that was the Atomic Dog. That was JYD. That was the Mid-South. That big DVD is coming out in a few weeks. Go get that. And that's going to do it for episode, I think this is 32 now. This is fantastic. We're moving right along. You want to email the show, turnbuckle throwbacks1@gmail.com. Facebook.com/TurnbuckleThrowbacks is the page. Join the group. T-Buckle T-Backs is the Twitter handle. Get a lot of feedback on that. I was talking to Justin Credible the other day. Nice to see him active on a Twitter machine. And he's a stable mate to check out, of course, everything that we're doing right now. We're doing big, big things. That's going to wrap it up. I've talked way too much. I have to start my day. And we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Mega Powers and I are working on a kick-ass throwback for all you guys. And maybe I'll jump on myself with some current stuff. Or maybe not. Guys, again, God bless. Take care of yourselves and each other. And peace out.
This is a story of famous dog. But the dog that chases its tail will be busy. These are clapping dogs, rhythmic dogs, harmonic dogs, house dogs, street dogs, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, counting dogs, funky dogs. Nasty dog.
Atomic dog. Atomic dog.
I had life on the cross. When they're out there walking the street,
may
compete.
But now,
oh, the dog.
Bow, wow, wow, yip, 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 yip. Bow, wow, yip, 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 yip. Bow, wow, wow, yip, 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 yip. Bow, wow, yip, 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 yip.
Untied dog. Ain't your average. Why must I feel like that? Hey, why must I chase the cat?
I'm
a dog in me.
I feel like that one more side to the cat. Nothing but a dog in me. Why must I feel like that one more side to the cat. Nothing but a dog in me. Why must I feel like that one more side to the cat. Nothing but a dog in me.
Dog in me.